Welcome to Calvary Life. This is the podcast of Calvary Baptist Church for our church membership, but also for anybody out there who's interested in local church life. And we've had a great conference this last couple of days, a Bible conference. It's the first time that we've put one of these on. It's been great to be a part of that. And we have some guests that have been with us, and we're continuing our podcast with those guests. By the way, I'm Charles Uptain.
Hey, I'm Paul Thompson. Let me introduce our super special guest today. And Professor Piercy, before I introduce you, now this may sound a little bit strange, but I just want to say thank you for being here. You've been so delightful to be around and just so engaging and talking to people. People have loved being around you. I think they want you to stay. So, you know, I hate to see you go today. We really mean that. It's been fantastic and so insightful. The lecture that you gave last night was so helpful. I think that's going to really set some real foundation stones in place for people. But if you don't know who I'm talking to or talking about, our guest today is Professor Nancy Piercy. She's a best-selling author, popular professor, as I mentioned. She teaches at Houston Christian University. She's a best-selling author of 7 books. 2 of those are ECPA Gold Medallion winners. One of those, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, and How Now Shall We Live, which harkens some of my favorites, like you mentioned. Francis Schaeffer and Chuck Colson. Other books include The Soul of Science, Finding Truth, which I know one of our local schools is using for its 10th grade class, which is fantastic. Saving Leonardo, Love Thy Body, which was the subject of our discussion last night. And most recently, The Toxic War on Masculinity. And that's one of the ones we're going to talk about today. So Professor Piercy is formerly an agnostic, but in coming to Christ has become a great defender of the faith and teacher of apologetics. The Economist refers to her, and I know you hate to be flattered, face-to-face in person, America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. So don't make us feel stupid today, Professor Piercy, if you can. She's spoken on campuses such as Princeton, Dartmouth, Stanford, USC, UC Davis, UC Santa Barbara, University of Georgia, spoken to staffers in Congress, the White House, scientists, Los Alamos National Laboratories, to actors, screenwriters, and Hollywood think tanks, public policy groups, Council for National Policy, Family Research Council, Faith and Law, Concerned Women for America. Some of you who are listening are part of Eagle Forum, I know, and Heritage Foundation. And so, Professor Piercy, thank you so much for giving some time and talking to us again today before you head back to Houston.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, the subject of the book, Toxic Masculinity, man, this is such a hot topic today. And I was mentioning a tweet thread that I read this morning. I thought maybe you could just jump in at this point. Give me your feedback on this. This is by Chase Davis, and I follow him on Twitter, and he provocatively just gave this title, Men, Do You Want to See American Culture Renewed? 10 Steps. And these are his 10 steps. Go to church. Find one that preaches the Bible. Go every Sunday. Sing loudly, even when you don't feel like it. 2, repent of your sins and put your faith in Jesus Christ. Make a practice of repentance, Bible reading and prayer daily. 3, take personal responsibility for your life. Reject a victim mindset. Exercise ownership in every area of your life. 4, get a job. Show up on time. Exceed expectations. 5, work out. Lift weights. Develop habits of health in your life. 6, get married. Marry a Christian woman. 7, take responsibility for your home. Lead your wife. 8, have children. Don't wait until you feel like you can afford it. I like this one. Have at least one more than you're comfortable having. I think we had 2 or 3 more than we were comfortable having. 9, raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If at all possible, do not send them to public school. And 10, stay married. Avoid divorce at all possible. Is that a good picture of biblical manhood?
That's an extremely good picture, and I do like Chase Davis, by the way. I've spoken at his church. I'll give you a simplified version of that. It's called the success... So the success sequence is what it's called, and its sociologists have put it out, and it was a response to poverty. And they discovered that if a person, especially a man, goes through the success sequence, he comes out on top. So this is the secular version of this, and it's much simpler. It says it's finish high school, get married and stay no, get a job first. Get a job, get married, and stay married. They found that if you finish school, then get a job, then get married and have children, you will not be poor. This was fascinating because they were presenting it as a solution to poverty, and they said, you know, it turns out if you do these simple, supposedly normal expectations, you will not be in poverty.
It seems, yeah, it does seem simple, but I guess rather profound, kind of countercultural for today.
It has become countercultural, and especially on the marriage part, because progressives have come out so strongly in education, the media, everywhere, on, well, diversity is good. Family diversity is good. And what they mean by that is, you know, don't necessarily get married or stay married. There was a study recently on how many young people think it's important to get married. You know, is that even one of your life goals? And the numbers were like in the 30s, 30%. And it was lower for women than for men. And I think it's because the feminist movement has really persuaded a lot of young women that they're not going to be happy in marriage. In fact, I heard from a friend just yesterday, because we were just talking about this issue, and she said, I teach high school, a Christian high school. All of my female students think they will be less happy getting married. They think that getting married, marriage is an oppressive institution, and you will be happier single than married, even in a Christian high school.
Is that just because they've been indoctrinated that way? Just that's what every movie, every television show, just every norm they've heard is, I mean,
exactly.
Is it that simple?
Exactly. Well, and elite opinion drives this. There have been some articles in places like the New York Times within the last several months saying things like, if you don't get married, you have more freedom, you have more fun, you have more wealth, you're not spending it on children, and, you know, advising young women that they will be much happier if they don't get married. So the irony about this, though, is elite opinion pushes this constantly, this message, but they themselves don't live that way. The people who get married and stay married are actually the upper levels of society, the ones who are better educated and wealthier are actually the highest in terms of having intact marriages and less, for example, less pregnancy outside of marriage. So that's the irony, that they themselves know what is happy. They know what's healthy, and that is get married, stay married, and don't let your kids, you know, sleep around or do drugs.
Wow.
They are living that way, but they are refusing to say that to the rest of culture. They have platforms like the New York Times, and they're using it not to promote the way they live, but a progressive ideology that is contrary to the way they live. That's the irony.
My curiosity makes me ask this question. I guess in one sense, sort of spiritually, pastorally, I say, okay, we're in spiritual battle. We're in spiritual warfare. Principalities, powers, rulers of darkness, that sort of thing. But on a, maybe a closer to earth sort of functional level, what's behind that? What's the payoff? I mean, this is what I live privately and personally, but this is what I espouse. How did we get here? What's the payoff of that?
Well, since we're talking about my book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, let me talk about the influences on men. Since I talked about women, young women are getting it mostly from the feminist movement. You're going to be happier if you're independent and don't get tied down to a man. But men are getting the same message as well, especially from the manosphere, you know, the group of online groups that are often hostile to women, hostile to marriage. And a lot of it is a reaction to the fact that, in fact, it has become socially acceptable to express hostility against men and masculinity. You know, one of the articles that caught my eye when I was deciding to write this book was an article in the Washington Post that was titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And I thought, really? In a mainstream publication like that? A Huffington Post editor tweeted, hashtag, kill all men. You can buy T-shirts that say, so many men, so little ammunition. You can buy books that are titled very bluntly, things like, I hate men, and no good men, and are men necessary? And then to my surprise, there are men who are jumping on that message and demeaning their own sex. There's a male author who wrote, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer.
How did this become such a bad word? I mean, even the title of the book, how did this become something that's considered toxic, that men being men? I mean, I guess it's kind of mind-boggling to me. I feel exactly what you're saying. I mean, you could just see it's pervasive everywhere. It's joked about in sitcoms, and of course I see it all over the Twitter sphere and that sort of thing. It's open season on men. I think maybe a reaction a little bit is some of these extreme versions of what a real man is that's not necessarily a biblical picture or a Christian worldview picture of men, but how did we get here? How did this become toxic to be what we are?
Well, you have to go back to when negative language first began to apply to men, and it's much earlier than most people think. Most people think, oh, 1960s, second wave feminism. But actually, you have to go all the way back to the 19th century, to the Industrial Revolution, because before that, men worked alongside their wives and children all day on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the cultural expectation for men focused on their caretaking role. In fact, surprisingly, most books and articles written on parenting back then were addressed to fathers, not to mothers, like they are today. And, of course, boys especially did work alongside their fathers all day as apprentices in the father's trade or craft. And even secular historians will talk about this. I love this. In one of my the books that I researched, it said the definition of masculine virtue was duty to God and man. And so the question is, how did we lose that? Well, the Industrial Revolution took work out of the home, and men had to follow their work out of the home. And for the first time in American history, they were not working alongside their family members, people they loved and had a moral bond with. They were working as individuals in competition with other men. And that's where you see the literature start to change. People said men are not, they're losing that caretaking ethos. They're becoming individualistic, self-seeking, egocentric, greedy and acquisitive, to use the language of the day, and turning their career into an idol. I was surprised how often people used that language back then. So this is when negative language first began to be applied to men, and especially to fathers. Right? Since fathers were out of the home all day, for the first time, they were not really as connected to the family dynamics. They weren't as aware of their kids' needs. And already in the 19th century, you see people begin to describe fathers as irrelevant, superfluous, out of touch, and incompetent. You know, it's the seeds of the Homer Simpson paradigm. So, and of course, if that's when it started, that suggests what the solution is, which is how can we reconnect fathers with their children, even in industrial age? Are there ways that we can restore the relationship between fathers and their children? And the pandemic was a game changer. Harvard University did a study. It came out after my book, so it's not in there. The conclusion of their study was, during the pandemic, fathers got closer to their children, and they don't want to lose that. 68% of fathers said they would prefer some kind of hybrid arrangement, at the very least, so that they could have more time at home with their kids. They found out during the pandemic they actually like being close to their kids.
Yeah, wow.
So that gives me hope that we can be more creative about the workplace.
It seems like maybe my demographic, Charles's demographic, Christian men, Christian fathers, Christian husbands, evangelical Christian men, that we're often in the crosshairs. We're the ones that are, we're the oppressive patriarchs, we're the domineering, we're the misogynists, we're the ones, even in our own convention, I know you're not part of Southern Baptist Convention, but so much talk about abuse reform and that sort of thing. And it seems like there's this image that if there's going to be abuse in a home, it's going to be carried out by, most likely by Christian men like us with our view of complementarianism, et cetera. But in your book, you talk about that really is not how it plays out. That's not what the evidence shows. Can you speak to that just a little bit? What do you see?
Right. Well, this is surprising for me as well, because the media narrative is that evangelical men are going to be exhibit A of toxic masculinity. I found lots of examples, but I'll give you just one. This was the co-founder of the Church Too movement, which followed the Me Too movement. And she said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. So the social scientists were listening to this and saying, well, where's your evidence? You're making these charges, but where's your data? And so they went out and did the studies. And in my book, I cite about a dozen studies that all found that the media narrative is totally debunked by the facts, that in fact, men who are committed, who attend church regularly, test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. They interview the wives separately, by the way, that's important. And so their wives test out as being the happiest with the way their husbands treat them. They spend the most time with their children, 3.5 hours more per week than secular men. They have the lowest rate of divorce, 35% lower than secular men. and they actually have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America. So sometimes a quote can really crystallize it. So let me give you one. This is the person who did the largest study is Brad Wilcox, who's a sociologist at the University of Virginia and founder of the National Marriage Project. So to give you a sense of his stature, he does get invited to write for places like the New York Times. So this was a New York Times article. And he said, direct quote, he said, "It turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives." They're testing the wives in particular, right? Because supposedly these marriages are oppressive to the wives. But no, the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives, fully 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high-quality marriages.
This is the exact opposite of what you would guess if you just look at the way things are presented. And you know, you said something, and this one convicts me a little bit, challenging me, because I've been guilty of using a very bad statistic here. And I want you to correct me on this, speak to this one a little bit more. I have said myself in a message about marriage, divorce, et cetera, and I guess I have just passed on what I had heard said to me, aren't divorce rates about the same in the church and out of the church? I've said that myself before, so I'm guilty of that. But your statistics and your studies are saying that's not the case.
It's the first pushback I always get, too, by the way. In fact, in my research, I found out it is one of the most widely used statistics by Christian leaders. So what the researchers did is they went back to the data, and they made that very crucial distinction between men who are authentically committed, church-going Christians and nominal Christians.
Ah, okay.
And my students don't even know what nominal means, so I explained to them NOM is Latin for name. So it means in name only. So these are men who on a survey like this might check, say, the Baptist box, for example, but who actually attend church rarely, if at all. And they test out shockingly different. They fit all the toxic stereotypes. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. They spend the least amount of time with their kids. They have a higher rate of divorce even than secular couples, 20% higher than secular couples. And they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence, even higher than secular men. And so here's what the church is up against. You know, on the one hand, how do we encourage the men who actually are doing much better than the media gives us credit for?
Yeah, so we're not beating them down all the time for not being men.
Let me give a quick example. So I have a graduate student who was the head of the women's ministry at a very large Baptist church in Houston. And she said, on Mother's Day, we hand out roses and tell the women they're wonderful. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better.
Yeah, that's true. That's really true. Or we give them a book that's correcting them or something. We honor the moms, yeah, for sure.
And so this data needs to come into the churches to encourage Christian men that they are actually doing very well. The more committed they are, the more closely they follow Jesus, they in fact do test out as the best husbands and fathers. But then how do we also reach out to these nominal men who are hanging around the fringes enough of the Christian world enough to pick up language like headship and submission? But what they do then is they infuse secular meanings into those terms of dominance, control, entitlement, and so on, and then but then we'll justify it biblically. Like, some people ask me why are they worse than secular men, and apparently that's it. You know, a secular guy who maybe is hitting his wife and kids doesn't feel any religious justification, but the nominal Christian man will say, well, you know, the Bible says I'm supposed to be the head of my home, so I can do what I want. Or she wasn't submissive enough, so I had to put her in her place. So he has religious justification for his abuse and ends up actually being worse than the secular man.
I want to seize on this part of the discussion just for a moment, a little extra, because this is a real challenging one for me from pastoral perspective, because I feel like, you know, when I'm teaching, say, going through Ephesians, for instance, about roles in marriage and wives respect your husbands, husbands love your wives. Just exactly what you're describing, that nominal Christian takes those things, and then what happens later, I'll hear the feedback from the wife is how he's lording it over me, how he's domineering me, how he's demanding my obedience, et cetera, but is in no way loving me like Christ loved the church. There's no self-sacrificial love. There's no Christ-filled, Spirit-led component of his role in that relationship, but demanding you know, it just it becomes a very it becomes a dangerous text in the wrong hands, I guess. And I guess that's what we're seeing in these nominal Christians. They use that as an excuse of justification for their dysfunctional marriage.
Yeah, so Stephen Tracy is one of the theologians I quote a lot in my book. He's at Phoenix Seminary. And I think the way he put it was this. You know, if you've got an insecure man to start with, he will take that language and use it to dominate his wife and children. If somebody's already an insecure person or an unhappy person, he's much more prone to misuse Scripture. And so I think you're right. It's a real challenge to the church. And how do I then address them on Sunday morning when I've got both the really committed men, but I probably have a number of nominal men in my church? By the way, I mostly spend time with very committed Christians, and so I kind of thought the nominals were a small group. And I did read only one study that gave the numbers. It's about the same size. Yeah. It's about the same size.
I don't think that surprises me anymore.
Yeah. So, by the way, I think we need to equip young Christian women that if they are dating a guy who claims to be a Christian, they have about a 50-50 chance that he's actually a nominal, you know, because yeah. They're the same, about 15% of the American population. You know, committed men and nominals are both about 15%. So you have, that means you have a 50-50 chance of actually running into a nominal.
So we've got to train them to discern the difference, the distinction between the two. You mentioned something in your book about men have two competing scripts for what masculinity is supposed to look like. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I love this. It is a result of a sociological survey. And the background to this is the most controversial book I've written, which actually surprised me.
Have you gotten pushback from it? This public pushback or academic pushback? Or
No, mostly Christian.
Really?
In the Christian world. Well, I wrote Love Thy Body, which is about homosexuality, transgenderism, abortion.
So we're all on same team on that.
And it turns out, yeah, more Christians are on the same team with that one. This one actually divides. Masculinity turns out to be more of a trigger word in Christian circles. I always do lots of reading groups in my books so that I kind of rub off the rough edges. And when they would tell their family and friends we're going through a manuscript on masculinity, invariably the first question was, whose side is she on? You know, like men tended to assume that a woman writing a book on masculinity was a male-bashing feminist. Mm-hmm. And more progressive types tended to assume that I was some, you know, hardcore culture warrior, you know, defending men. So I put this the study right at the beginning of the book to kind of overcome that initial suspicion. So this was done by a sociologist. He's not a Christian. His name is Michael Kimmel, but he's well known in his field, and so he gets invited to speak all around the world. So he came up with this ingenious experiment where he asked young men two questions. First, he would say, what does it mean to be a good man? You're in a funeral, and in the eulogy, somebody says, he was a good man. What does that mean? And the sociologist said, all around the globe, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately start listing things like honor, duty, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, look out for the little guy, be a provider, be a protector, be responsible. And he'd say, well, where'd you learn that? I don't know. It's just in the air we breathe. Or if they were in a Western country, they would often say it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage. But it was universal. It was not just the Christian countries. And so I would say men are made in God's image, and they do know that their unique masculine strengths are not given them to just get whatever they want, but to provide, protect, and care for those that they love. But then he followed up with a second question. And he said, what does it mean to you if I say, man up, be a real man? And the young men themselves said, oh, no, that's completely different. You know, that means be tough, never show weakness, suck it up, play through pain, be competitive, get rich, get laid. I'm using their language. Very different traits.
One has a very positive connotation, this is honorable, and the other has, this is the negative side of being a man.
These are the toxic, what we now call toxic. Now, some of them, I mean, we all want people to hang tough in a crisis. They're not all bad, but certainly if they get disconnected from a moral vision, it can slide into the negative or toxic traits. And so this sociologist concludes that men are torn between these two scripts. They do know what it means to be a good man. It's universal. It's innate. It's inherent. But what it means is that we have a much better way to approach these issues. Most men do not respond well to being called toxic. I mean, nobody would. So what we can do is can we appeal to, can we support, can we affirm that innate knowledge of what it means to be the good man? And that gives us a much more positive way to approach these issues.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the kind of pushback that you got from Christians on this? Like particular points of opposition? Was it something specific in the book? Was that the kind of the generality of the theme of it? Or
most Christians don't know what apologetics is. I'm doing apologetics in this book. I'm equipping Christians to answer the secular culture. You know, that's my main goal. All my books are apologetics in some way. So my emphasis is always on how do we respond effectively to the secular culture. In the Christian church, they just want to drag the book into a very in-house, insular debate of a complementarian versus egalitarian. And both sides have jumped on the book. The egalitarians have been particularly shrill, angry, you know, creating huge Twitter storms, attacking the book, saying, you know, you're being nice to complementarian men. Or theologically conservative men they didn't even study complementarian men. They studied theologically conservative men, the social scientists. You know, they're both psychologists and sociologists. They weren't studying egalitarian versus complementarian. In fact, in my book, I explain that I'm not even dealing with that issue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's really not primarily about that.
No,
I mean, that might be a secondary or downstream application from it.
And the reason I don't, I mean, I put this right in the book. Two of my top researchers say it doesn't seem to make a difference. One of them was the sociologist I already quoted, Brad Wilcox, the one who was in the New York Times. The other is John Gottman, who is considered the top marriage psychologist in the country. Both of them said, you know, in our practice or in our studies, we get some men who think they should be in charge of the marriage, and we get others who are more egalitarian. And the complementarian ones aren't any... Are not any less happy. And the egalitarians are not any happier. You would think they would be, but they're not. And so here's how John Gottman puts it. Emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the most important thing, which is how to convey honor and respect to your wife. Or as Wilcox puts it, a husband's gender theory doesn't seem to make any difference in how happy his marriage is.
I'm wondering, too, based on... And what you do, obviously, and you're with students so frequently. What kind of reception did you get from students? Is this required reading for any of your classes?
Yes. The Houston Christian University did let me teach a class on it, which was fun. Actually, let me finish the Twitter debates, because that's been huge. It's been huge. On the one hand, the Christian egalitarians have been the fiercest in attacking the book. But then the neo-patriarchalist, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would ask you to do this, but I wouldn't put you in that spot. I'm thinking of some names myself, but I won't ask you to name them. But I think I know I think I know the category.
They have not been nearly as fierce, but they have also weighed in, you know. So Twitter's been incredibly lively. But in my classes, do you know where, I get the most pushback from my young female students who all identify as feminists. They all identify as feminists.
Because that's just the cultural baseline now?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they come into the university with.
And so I get the most pushback from them. I'll give you an example. In the chapter on fatherhood, I have a whole chapter devoted to that, and I cite a study. It was a 35-year longitudinal study. So it was very extensive, won all kinds of awards, and it was on how do families successfully pass on their religious beliefs. And what they found out is two surprising things. One is fathers matter more than mothers. And you know, so if a father has a high level of religious participation, his kids will follow him. And they do mothers too, but not as much. And my feminist students are all like, that's not fair.
What's your interpretation of that?
And I say, I'm sorry, but it's a fact.
So you've got the data. How do you explain the data? How do we interpret that?
It is. And by the way, the second surprising thing is it does depend on the quality of the relationship. In other words, the father can be a moral exemplar, a pillar of the church, have perfect theology, but if he's perceived as cold, distant, and authoritarian, then his kids won't follow him. So it turns out the most important part is that it's a warm, close, loving relationship.
Can you give some thoughts on how dads can cultivate that, how they can cultivate that sort of relationship and benefit to their kids? And
let me give you another study, because it's kind of the same angle, but from a secular perspective. So there was a study done on how to produce masculine boys, and they found the same thing. It was amazing. They found it does not matter whether the masculinity of the father, you know, whether he's macho or whether he's more gentle. They too, from a secular perspective, found that boys will grow up with a secure sense of masculinity if they have a warm, close, loving relationship with their father. So if you're, that's, you know, as Christian fathers, we're concerned about that as well. And the answer to that then is no, you don't have to be rough and tough. And, you know, if you're not that type of guy, it's okay. You still can produce sons with a secure sense of masculinity, you know, if their father affirms them. Here's how one psychologist put it. He wrote a book on, it's called Man Enough. So he's a psychiatrist, and Frank Pittman. And he said, you know, if the father is distant, the son, and especially if the father's gone, right? 40% of American households are, of American children, rather, 40% of American children are growing up apart from their natural father. 40%. It's the highest rate of single parenthood in the world. So if the father's not there physically or emotionally...
People can't see, but I'm just shaking my head here at the data. It's just, it's so troubling. Sorry,
yeah, Nancy. It is. And if the father isn't present physically or emotionally, then a son feels like, well, I have to go out there to find my masculinity, you know, because they don't have a father there to affirm them. And he said, but if the father is there affirming them, loving them, then here's how the psychiatrist puts it, then he feels like he's joined the company of men, right? And he can feel secure in his masculinity.
Do you have any thoughts for recommendation for a church, for instance? How do we help? How do we come alongside single moms with no present dads? Yeah, that's the home I grew up in. I grew up with no dad at home. My parents were divorced sometime I was two, so it was just my mom raising me and two older brothers and an older sister. So we had the benefit of loving church family and men in the church that took interest in us. And so I kind of have a sense from my own formation of how it happened for me. But what thoughts do you have for a church like us with how do we help? How do we come alongside single moms?
Well, the 35-year longitudinal study did have a whole chapter on grandparents. Because I get that question from grandparents a lot, right? Well, can we help? And the answer is yes. The study showed that grandparents can have a huge impact. But also other father figures, you know, the other extended family like uncles, coaches and teachers and church youth group leaders and big brother programs all can have a huge impact. And so it is a point that I make in my book is I say churches should start thinking in terms of really making that a priority, a ministry to fatherless children and especially fatherless boys. It would be good to see churches actually, you know, intentionally make that part of their ministry.
This, you know, this has so much practical application for us. You know, we just see this, we see the collapsing culture all around us, and often we hear it attributed to the lack of male roles, and what male roles we see, what's presented in media seems to be genuinely negative, ungodly views of what masculinity is. How do we as a church get people interested in this so that they begin to study? Like we're trying to do things with men right now, for instance. We just recognize the need for men to get together, for instance, to encourage one another, help one another, because it seems like from a couple of guys sitting here that the women in our church do this much more naturally. So if there's an event for women, they'll come, and we do a thing called Coffee and Connect, and they'll come, and they'll have coffee and cookies, and they'll sit and talk. For men, we tend to just do our own thing. We're just out there, so we're trying to connect. How can we encourage one another in this? What are some things that we could do as a church family?
You know, there is a website called Church for Men, and it's by an author who wrote a book called Why Men Hate Going to Church. Are you familiar with this?
Yes. Familiar with the premise for sure. I haven't read the book.
You would like the book because it's not particularly profound. He gives fairly simple, doable recommendations on how to make your church more men-friendly, because the average congregation in America is 60% female and 40% male. And that's enough that a lot of the, you know, decor and songs, you know, can be more geared towards women. And so even simple things like that. How do you have a more masculine decor? You know, he'll talk about that. How do you have songs like, well, this morning you guys had "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," right? And "Crown Him with Many Crowns." You had good, solid hymns that are, you know, strong content, and that are not just so many of the popular courses. Yeah,
not just emotive.
Yes, and, yes.
Yeah, sure.
So for very practical tips, Church for Men is a good website. And by the way, the author endorsed my book. So he gave me really good feedback on the book. He was very helpful. But also, I want to spend a little bit of time, too, you know, being the apologist. You know, how do we counter the secular messages? In my book, I go through several stages on how, you know, what we call toxic is basically the secular view of masculinity. And how did that secular view develop? And a key turning point was the rise of Darwinian evolution. And that's surprising because we think that has to do with science. It had a huge impact on concepts of masculinity. The Darwinian writers, you know, in the late 19th century immediately started saying, well, the men who won out on top in the struggle for survival would be ruthless, barbarian, savage, and even predatory, brutal. That was the favorite word. And so that message is still out there today. The word social Darwinism got changed to evolutionary psychology. But there's a best-selling book called The Moral Animal, and the author says, the human male is an oppressive, possessive, flesh-obsessed pig. Giving men advice on how to have a good marriage is like giving Vikings a booklet on how not to pillage.
Wow.
And this is a best-selling book. This is where the Andrew Tates of the world are coming from, right? The fast cars, fast money, fast women. Another example, though, is a book that – it's an older book that was just reissued called Men in Marriage. And he says, men are by nature addiction-prone, irresponsible, and sexually predatory. Their deepest yearning is not for wife and family, but for the open road – for the male group escape to, what does he say? He says, to an immediate and predatory gratification. I'm like, wait, you sound worse than any feminist.
Sure. Yeah. You know, if we buy into that worldview, it's just, I hope everybody's just thinking through all the implications of that, how that justifies so much horrific behavior and the worst of our fallen selves. If we buy into that is at our core who we are, and anything different than that, we're fighting against ourselves, we're fighting against our very nature, our evolutionary selves, then, well, that's incredibly destructive.
So I got an email from a former graduate student who's now teaching high school, and she said, all my students are fans of Andrew Tate. They're even using Andrew Tate quotes in the yearbook. I said, where do you teach? At a classical Christian school. So here's what we're up against. If the church is not presenting a positive, inspiring view of masculinity, our young people are going to the Andrew Tates of the world, you know, the online influencers, and they're thinking that is true masculinity.
Yeah. They're getting their masculinity from Andrew Tate, Joe Rogan, et cetera, whatever they see in the world. It's
well, the one who's now kind of a rising star, he was promoted as the new Andrew Tate by the New York Post. His name is Myron Gaines. And his tagline is, I help men transform from simps into pimps.
Myron Gaines. I'm going to write this one down. I'm kind of out of touch. John Adams, you know who Myron Gaines is? Okay. We ask our resident college age person.
Some people know the title of this program better. It's Fresh and Fit.
Fresh and Fit. Okay.
And he has written a book. And in his book, he says, all the relationship between the sexes has always been transactional. All men are Johns. All women are whores. And so his show is becoming rapidly very popular. Wow. And if Christian men, you know, Christian men are sometimes taking this in. Oh, and the sexually predatory part is both Tate and Gaines say men are naturally sexually promiscuous. You know, that's just their nature. Women have to understand that. They might have a favorite girlfriend, but she needs to understand that he's going to have a lot of girls on the side, and because that's the male nature and we can't change it.
And so are our young women. Is there, I mean, you're seeing them come up through college ranks. Are they accepting that this is the norm that they're going to have to live with? This is what they're going to have to deal with. This is reality.
So why do you think they're not saying they want to get married? Yes.
What are they looking for? I mean, maybe that's kind of a loaded question, but when you talk to these young women who are college students or graduate students, what are they hoping to find? Those that want to get married, what sort of men are they looking for?
So I was on a podcast not long ago with a young woman, and her name is Alex Clark. She's with TPUSA. And she said, how can men help women to be soft and feminine, and how can women help men to be strong? And my answer was, well, they have to start by respecting women when they're soft and feminine. Because a lot of men, apart from anatomy, almost would prefer another male. And you see, if a woman's soft, gentle, sweet-natured, well, many men will, if a man were that way, they wouldn't respect him. They would think it was weakness. And there are a lot of men who really don't respect women when they are soft and sweet and loving and kind. And I think we need to start by recognizing, we say we're in favor of recognizing the differences between men and women, but then a lot of men actually don't respect women who are gentle and soft and kind. They respect you if you stand up to them. Mm-hmm. And women would prefer to be feminine. But they find that they can't live that way with many men.
So they're being conditioned in the world that they're growing up in. And just as yes. you mentioned at the conference, the hookup culture and what that's creating and the it's a devastating thing. This is sort of a sidebar, but I want to talk just a little bit because this is an issue that presses us in SBC Life and other denominations too. It's just the issue of abuse, and it's related to men's view of women and respect for women, that sort of thing. I don't know if you saw this or not. This was in Twitter this week. Maybe this is out there in sort of the far reaches of the Twitter sphere. But did you happen to see the clips of the pastor who was speaking about women wearing shorts? Did you see this? In these horrific comments, now there's been so much pushback. And his comment was something to the effect of, if you go to the outlet mall here in Gatlinburg, you're going to see more women wearing shorts than pants. And if that woman is raped, I tell you, if I'm on that jury, I'm letting that man go free. And of course, he got some pushback. I can't believe he still has a job as a pastor anywhere. But what does that say about if in any way, and this is a white evangelical pastor, if any way we're portrayed like that, are we conveying that sort of image? Because if there is a definition of toxic masculinity masquerading as Christianity, that would surely be it. I guess I'm just ranting on that. I mean, what were your thoughts on that when you saw it? I mean, surely you just, you know, it's repulsive to hear, but what does that say about us? What does that say about a church that you can stand up and say that in?
Well, because nominal men do have higher rates of abuse, higher than secular men, of course I did have to deal with that in the book.
Nominal Christians have higher rates of abuse of spouses, of their wives, than secular men in general.
That's true.
I mean, this is something I'm repeating that, not because you didn't say it clearly, but I just want people to hear that again. That's something that we need to hear. So there is a truth to the perception that abuse is happening in churches.
And even among committed Christian men, it's not zero, right? It's low, but it's not zero. But by the way, I started the book with my own story because I grew up in a home with a very abusive father. He was severely physically abusive. He would punch us. His favorite was the knuckle punch, you know, the knuckle fist, I mean, you know, where he would extend the middle finger for a sharper stab of pain. And so I put that at the front of the book and to say, well, I'll quote a psychologist who read the book, and he came to me and he said, well, at least we know you're not talking from an ivory tower.
Wow,
you know,
really?
You're writing from the trenches. In other words, it wasn't easy for me to come to a high view of masculinity, a positive view, because that's what I grew up with. And by the way, of course, as I became an adult, I ricocheted way over into feminism. read all the foundational feminist books, always had some feminist book on my bedside table. And then I became a Christian and had to start rethinking the whole question. So I do have a, partly because of my own experience and partly because of as you just reiterated, nominal Christian men have the highest rate of abuse. And see, my father attended church every Sunday, so he was one of the ones who do attend church, and still there's some abuse even in among those men. But books on abuse, first of all, most of them address women and hold women accountable. To be charitable, it's probably because that's the only person you have access to. The man is not going in for counseling. Whether it's a secular counsel, whether it's pastoral counseling, whether it's just reading books and articles, it's mostly women who are seeking help for their relationship, for their marriage. But the upshot was that many women were then essentially told, well, it's your fault. You know, if you would just be more loving, if you would be more submissive, if you would make his favorite foods, you know, if you would have sex more often, he will blossom into the man you want him to be. That was quoting a pastor talking to an abused woman whose story I tell. He will blossom into the man. Well, it turns out that's just not true to human nature. If someone's a bully, you know, if you're willing to hurt someone to get your way, you are a bully. And we know that acquiescing or appeasing a bully doesn't work. I mean, we know that from the playground bully. We know that from belligerent nations. If you try to appease them, they get worse. And in fact, that is what happens in abuse in the home. If you try to appease and placate, they get worse because they figure, you know, you're giving me permission. So it turns out, what's the answer then? The answer is the same thing Jesus said for all sin, Matthew 18. Matthew 18 says, if somebody is sinning, you confront him. You say, this is wrong. And if they don't listen to you, you bring a few more witnesses in. And if they don't listen to them, you bring it before the whole church. And if they don't listen to them, it might be time for some form of church discipline. And so somehow the sin of a husband was just sort of exempt from that. But that's Jesus' answer to sin. Yeah. And I suggest that that's, you know, that's the answer for the abuse in Christian homes.
I wonder, I just wonder what sort of job most churches are doing. I mean, certainly it's something we have to be aware of, and we try to be as biblical as we can in practicing church discipline rightly and so. But like you said, this is often such a hidden thing, and sometimes abuse becomes such a, I won't say it's nebulous, but sometimes abuse can be, it can be hard to define sometimes. That abuse that's verbal and constant, that abuse that's so demeaning and so, you know, that just typically flies under the radar, whereas we tend to focus in on physical abuse only, that there are other kinds of abuse that can
exactly.
wreck a family.
You know, I have three stages in my book. I say difficult marriage, and then verbal abuse, and then physical abuse. So I have it kind of separated out so it's easier to identify each one. And you know what? There are actually a lot of good books on the subject that have come out recently. You know, when I used to read them and trying to deal with my dad, like I said, they mostly blamed the woman. They've come out now with Christian psychologists are now writing books that are very good, you know, that are much more geared towards, no, let's hold somebody accountable. And to be fair, sometimes it is the woman who's verbally abusive. You know, then, and I have a couple of examples of that just so that people see that I'm even-handed. But it's percentage-wise, it is more likely the man. And it's certainly if it gets to the level of physical abuse, it's almost always the man because men are bigger and stronger. And they, you know, if the altercation gets physical, who's going to end up injured or in the hospital? You know, it is going to be the woman usually, unless she has a weapon. I had one of my students said, well, I knew this girl who had a knife. Okay, fine. If the woman has a weapon. But really, the majority. Here's a statistic that's shocking. Half of all female homicides, female murders, are domestic partners. Half of all women who are married is by, and by domestic partner they mean husband or former husband, boyfriend or former boyfriend. The comparable number for men is 3%. So clearly, if there's abuse, it should be taken seriously because women sometimes pay for it with their lives.
What was the primary motivation for writing this book? Is it you're dealing with young people and you're seeing the shift? I'm sure over time, over a span of time in teaching students, you've just seen, I mean, you see the cultural shifts. You see the worldview shifts right in front of you on a regular basis. But What was the big impetus?
Well, I was surprised to see how acceptable it's become to express overt hostility to men. You may have seen this one. It's not in the book because it's more recent. But the director of the movie Avatar was in the news because he said testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So on the one hand, I wanted to explain where this comes from, right? Like I said earlier, I equip Christians to deal with the culture, and they need to know how to deal with this level of hostility.
A Darwinian worldview.
And the consequence, and it's, I think, in part a consequence of that hostility, is men and boys are, in fact, falling behind on all kinds of measures. You know, boys are falling behind at all levels of education. It starts in kindergarten. They don't have as good fine motor control, so they have trouble operating scissors. Right? So already in kindergarten, they feel like they're inferior, and they're behind in both test scores and grades all through high school. Colleges now are 60% female.
I was about to say, you probably see that in your graduate classes, particularly the percentage of women over men.
Well, the average is 60 female, 40% male, but no, Houston Christian, when I started there, was 70-30.
Wow.
Smaller Christian schools are 70-30. And that's why we started a football team, and we started an engineering school to attract more males. And places like Harvard, there have been articles on this, that they are quietly trying to have kind of an affirmative action program to get more male students. So they don't want to go past 60-40. And you know, if they don't do something, it will. It will go past that.
I think hopefully part of the audience that will read the book, I'm thinking of young men. I'm thinking of like my – I have two young 20-something sons and a future son-in-law. And, you know, I want them to feel, if this is the right word, the permission to be men that I think really the culture wars against, that they're afraid to be the sort of men that they actually are created to be, that God wants them to be.
So I told my class that I was writing a book on masculinity, and one of my male students shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." I thought, oh, okay. You know, yes, young men are feeling that. And then I quote a psychotherapist. She writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal. And she said, "The young men coming into my practice are increasingly demoralized and depressed because they feel like they're growing up in a culture that's hostile to masculinity." And by the way, men are falling behind. You know, once they're out of school, they're falling behind in terms of both where they used to be and in relative to women. Men are more likely to be homeless, mentally ill, drug and alcohol addicted. Of course, crime, 90% or more of prison inmates are male. Unemployment. It's not showing up in the unemployment statistics because they're not even looking for work anymore. So researchers had to dig deeper, and they tell us that male unemployment is now at Great Depression-era levels. That was a shocker because we remember what a crisis that was. And life expectancy has also gone down. Women's has stayed the same, but male life expectancy has gone down. A lot of it is what they call deaths of despair, you know, drug overdoses and so on. So that there was a magazine called The New Scientist that did an article on this, and they said, the major demographic factor now in early death is being male.
It's just being male.
So this is what we're up against. This is why I wrote the book, too. I said, you know, we need to respond to these trends and get some help. You know, the reason girls moved ahead educationally was they had a lot of help. Right? The 1972 Title IX, 1994 Gender Equity Act put millions of dollars into equity workshops, curricula that encouraged girls, training materials. And you see, people thought, well, what we'll do is we'll bring girls up to where boys are. Nobody anticipated that the girls would charge right past.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question here because somebody might be listening thinking, why do we need to help men? I mean, don't they have all the positions of power and influence and they dominate society and we live in a patriarchal society, et cetera? But really, that's not what you're describing.
It's true that a lot of the top positions are still men, but that is maybe 10%. And it blinds us to the fact that on average, men are doing worse, both educationally, employment, and all of these levels, health, and so on. Men are actually doing worse on level. And And I'm like, especially for education, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Girls got all kinds of help. Isn't it maybe time to have some programs for boys, you know, to have some compassion on boys and men and say, oh, there's some programs that might help them succeed better?
Well, hopefully the perspective that you can bring as a woman writing this book on masculinity will cause it to have a wider audience, have a wider level of acceptance. I think that's a we didn't even mention that, but I think that's a pretty amazing thing and a pretty cool thing. Professor Piercy, where can people, besides in our bookstore here at Calvary, so if you're local and you're listening to this, we purchased a lot of copies of Professor Piercy's book and several other books too, so we have those, so you can come by here anytime and pick one of those up. But where can they get their hands on this book and other materials from you, and how can they find out more?
Right. So you can, of course, go to Amazon, like you do for everything,
yeah.
Or ChristianBook.com. But my publisher generously redesigned my website, so it's fun and colorful now. So I'd like to invite you to come there, NancyPiercy.com. And Piercy is P-E-A-R-C-E-Y. Don't forget the E-Y. NancyPiercy.com. You can browse my other books that way. You can leave a message. I love it when people leave little messages and I read them. NancyPiercy.com. Come on over and say hi.
Okay, let me say this real quick, too. This is not the advertisement we wanted to give. I don't know. But I thought this is a really neat opportunity for maybe a select few. It is possible to audit some of the classes that Professor Piercy teaches. So you can find that information out on Houston Christian University site. Is anything else they should look for on that? I just thought, you know, some of those, I mentioned that to you when we were talking privately. There are some of those courses, and they were offered at a time where I couldn't take them because of church obligation. I thought I really would love to spend the semester in that, just to dig in a little more deeply into that. So there's some possibility there for those, yes, who are really wanting to do more, dig in more.
Yeah, this I have really enjoyed this new trend. We're really expanding our auditing program where people can come in. It's not online, because online is, you do on your own time. But auditing is where you actually come in via Zoom. And we see you. There's a big screen on the wall, so the students see you coming in, and you see the students. And the auditing students participate just as if they were in the classroom. It's wonderful. And we've had students from all around the world, too, from places like the Philippines and Switzerland and Canada, where else? Japan. So it's been a wonderful way to help people who, they don't need the credit, right? They're just doing it for personal enrichment. So take a look at our site on auditing. There's a legal definition of auditing that we don't quite fit, so we also call it surveying. So don't get confused. Come to our audit/surveying page, and you can
see. Just a great opportunity, though, if somebody wants to dig in a little bit deeper. But I hope you'll avail yourself of those opportunities. Go to nancypiercy.com. If you're local, again, if you're a Calvary member, stop by our resource area. We'd love to get you a copy of that book, get one of those in your hands. And Professor Piercy, thank you so much for all that you contributed to the life of this church. And really, I think downstream, that's really the reason we did this conference, to encourage people, but also help them with their own families, their own relationships and friendships, their children, their grandchildren. And I really think they're going to be real dividends from seeds planted this weekend. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I was very happy to be here.
All right, so we are Calvary Baptist Church. This is Calvary Life, and we're glad that you have been with us. And remember, we are for God, for Dothan, for the world.